Trendstorm.
Welcome to Radio Sputnik and Trendstorm. My name is Andrew Kripko, and I'm going to give you a forward-focused analysis of things to come and the general trends behind them. Here's what we have for you today. European Intervention Force, a mini NATO? The surprise decision of 9 EU states to form a rapid intervention force for responding to crises near the bloc's borders looks like a redundant attempt to build a mini NATO. Syria, the drama in Daraa. The Russian-assisted liberation offensive by the Syrian Arab Army in the terrorist-occupied portions of the southwestern de-escalation zone has the chance of causing international drama after both the U.S. and Israel warned against such a move. And also, Yemen, stalemate on the Red Sea. The Saudi-led coalition's offensive on the Houthi-led Yemeni Red Sea port of Hodeidah seems to have stalled over the past week, with the resultant stalemate raising hopes for a political solution. Opening up this edition of Trendstorm is the European Intervention Force. The surprise decision of 9 EU states to form a rapid intervention force for responding to crises near the bloc's borders looks like an attempt to build a mini NATO. Although something of the sort had been talked about for a while now, and other regional security structures already exist on the continent, the timing and membership of the European Intervention Force speaks to its possible purpose in distinguishing it from all others. France, Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, Denmark, Estonia, and even the UK all came together less than a week before the upcoming EU summit that's expected to intensely focus on migration. And with Italy's new government not yet ruling out membership, it looks likely that the EIF will attempt to become a more effective instrument for responding to the crisis. In addition, the EIF is, for the most part, a bloc of Western European countries that have come to represent so-called Old Europe, with the exception of Estonia, of course, which represents a more concentrated regional military focus than the EU-wide PESCO. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg praised the initiative for having the potential to improve Europeans' military readiness, while French Defense Minister Florence Parly highlighted its intent in creating a European strategic culture that can contribute to anticipating crisis and responding quickly and effectively. From the looks of it, the EIF is intended to be an EU-led mini-NATO that's much more relevant for Western Europe's needs than the transatlantic bloc as a whole. The optics of this initiative therefore run the risk of exacerbating East-West tensions within the EU by contributing to the perception of a two-speed Europe that the former communist states have loudly spoken out about over the past few years. Furthermore, bearing the EIF's presumed purpose in mind and considering the backdrop of the migrant crisis, legitimate concerns can be raised about whether this military force will be deployed beyond the Mediterranean and into Africa itself, potentially to assist with the so-called disembarkation centers that have been unofficially proposed for certain North and West African countries. Whether it ultimately fulfills this role or not, the EIF is nevertheless a watershed event in the EU's post-Brexit military history and provides a sense of direction for where the bloc, or at least part of it, might be headed during these uncertain times. So folks, I gotta say, this announcement caught a lot of people off guard because nobody really expected it. Now, we're gonna start off our conversation by speaking with Mr. Lars Jorgensen. He's a Danish sociologist and political commentator who blogs at homosociologicus.com.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Lars, yep. The European Intervention Force looks to be the first step in the creation of a so-called EU army, seeing as how it's supposed to be leaner and more effective than the bloc-wide PESCO or the transatlantic NATO. So, Lars, what's your reaction to this development, and what do you think its purpose is?
Yeah, it's an interesting and worrying development, I think. Let me start out with a quote, because, what we are told by the European politicians and bureaucrats are not exactly what we are. We have no reason to have confidence in what they're saying. And 20 years ago, the great French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu said that Europe doesn't say what it does, it doesn't do what it says, it says what it does not do. It does what it doesn't say. Europe is an optical illusion. So what the statements that we get from the European politicians about what they're doing and what they're up to, we can under no circumstances rely on what they're saying. And I think that the newest development is another coup d'etat of the European peoples. And I'm very worried that they are going to use this European army force to, you know, to use it for their geopolitical agendas and basically simply using it for corporate powers' interests. That's what I think.
Oh, yeah. You know, you made some good points that you can't take the words at face value because politicians lie and mislead. And that's certainly the truth all across the world and especially in Europe. Now, we're going to talk about the agenda here. And what really struck me as interesting to even try to understand what the purpose is the fact that Italy's government didn't join this force, but it also didn't rule out doing so sometime in the future. So what do you think its reluctance was? I mean, why was it so reluctant to join the European Intervention Force, and what could possibly become its purpose? I mean, some people are talking about this force being used to combat illegal migration. On the surface, we would think that's in Italy's interest, especially given their new government, yet they're still reluctant to join. So why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, Italy is in big trouble economically, and the EU is killing Italy just like it's been killing Greece for the past 15 years, at least the past 10 years. And so there's great skepticism in Italy, a very, very well-founded skepticism about what's from the EU and from the establishment. So I guess that must be the reason why the new government is reluctant to join. And also, when we're talking about what the purpose of this new army is, I mean, what we've seen the past 10 years or 15 years is that the EU has joined the American wars without hesitation, basically. And we had France saying no to Iraq with in 2001, but after that, all the other European countries have joined. And now what we are seeing in Europe is the same phenomenon from the American policies. And they have wars in South America, and then they have migrants coming, fleeing the destroyed nations from the South. This is a cynical scheme that most people are not able to even imagine, because while we're destroying nations in Africa and in the Middle East and for corporate plunder, then the workers and both the well-educated and the poor fleeing Europe. And this is actually a good thing for the corporate interests, because then they are coming to Europe and they are pressuring the wages for the workers and then creating a chaos.
I see.
And nobody's talking about this. Nobody is seeing the connection or talking about the connection between the wars and the migration. So even the left politicians in Europe are powerless to do something about it. So we have, the left politicians who are simply accepting that we have to take the migrants, and of course from a human perspective we have, but it's the wars that are causing it.
True.
And I think this new army could very well be used in Africa, for instance, and instead of helping the migrant situation, it could very well ensure that it will only further lead to more migration from Africa.
Okay.
Because there are strong nations in Africa.
I see. So if I understand you properly, then what you're saying is that the cynical corporate interest at play here, and specifically regarding the African angle, might be behind Italy's reluctance to join this new military force. Now, Lars, we have about less than a minute left. So just briefly, I want to ask you, we have in this new military force, mostly it's Western European countries. How do you think the Eastern European countries are perceiving this as regards their concerns about a so-called two-speed Europe? And we got about less than a minute left.
Yeah, the Hungarian, you can say they've chosen the right-wing solution, which is to be very firm and step down on migration. And this is, from a human perspective, a very indecent form to do it. But I think that they have the analysis you can find it in the literature called the weaponization of migration, of refugees. And this is used as a weapon further, you know, create chaos in Europe. And I don't approve of the policy, but they have the analysis. But the only thing I can see that is sensible to do about it is to stop the wars. And they are not doing the exact opposite. And this is what this new army is for. You know, Denmark had a reservation about joining such an army. But this one, Denmark is joining, so they're actually betraying the Danish people, going outside their mandate from the people. And I don't know what Eastern European countries will do. I mean, Poland is very much cooperating with the Americans, and Ukraine is... they've had a coup supported by the EU and America. But people in Europe don't know this, simply. Most people have no idea because it's never discussed in the media. I think the Italian people know this. They're very skeptical because they feel the consequences of the cynical bureaucrats.
Yeah, and that would explain why they were reluctant to join this force so large. Thank you for revealing the cynical corporate motives that might be at play in the creation of the European Intervention Force and its possible deployment to Africa. I thought that it was very interesting, and I was happy that you came on the program. So thanks again. Okay, and now we're going to get a different view on things from Mr. Patrick Joseph McGrath. He's an Irish journalist who has been living and working in Crimea for the past 4 years. He also witnessed the Crimean unification process in February to March of 2014.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Patrick, which of the UK's interests, if any, are served through its membership in the French-led European Intervention Force, and what drove London to join this initiative in the first place, considering that it's currently negotiating its exit from the EU?
For several centuries, the British Crown has maintained a policy which, if we adopt a purely strategic, amoral perspective, is a very pragmatic policy. That policy is known as perpetual war. What this policy means is that at any given point in time, there is always, at the very least, a small contingent of British soldiers deployed in a conflict zone somewhere in the world. From one era to the next, it may be a smaller or larger number of soldiers. In some periods, the number may be as low as 2,000 or 3,000. Of course, from 2002 until the British Army's withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2014, the number was significantly higher than that. Nonetheless, it's a very pragmatic policy to remain perpetually at war, to always have a small contingent of soldiers deployed somewhere. This is especially the case if a large proportion of the soldiers deployed are paratroopers. In practical terms, a paratrooper's lifespan as a combat soldier is 5 or 6 years. After that, there's usually too much wear and tear on the soldier's back and joints. Jumping out of airplanes with 20 or 30 kilos on your back is a young man's game. So in practical terms, a generation in the army is 5 or 6 years. Each generation needs to produce a core group of soldiers with combat experience who will be the instructors for the next generation. So the policy of perpetual war is vital to maintaining the United Kingdom's combat readiness. Of course, this is centrally what the Northern Ireland conflict was about, the perfect little localized training war, not too expensive, right next door. So given that perpetual war is such a long-standing Crown policy, I think that we have to see Britain's involvement in the European Intervention Force in that historical context. In a period without significant numbers of ground troops committed to NATO missions, the British government may be apprehensive about an experience gap developing in this generation of the army.
Okay, this is a very fascinating explanation, Patrick. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Now, I want to ask you about Estonia, because that country looks to be the odd one out of this otherwise Western European bloc, since it's a former Soviet republic from Eastern Europe. So, Patrick, what are the chances that this tiny country influences the European Intervention Force to take on some anti-Russian competencies on top of its presumed anti-migrant ones?
From the perspective of the Estonian government, their involvement in the European Intervention Force is motivated by a number of factors. Firstly, it gives them an opportunity to glean experience of cooperation with their allies outside of their own territory, and in addition to their participation in the Sabre strike military exercises. This was also one of the key factors motivating the Estonian government's decision to deploy soldiers to Afghanistan in May. Strategically, yes, the development of the military preparedness of the Western Alliance's Baltic partners would be seen as part of a strategy of developing overall preparedness for a hypothetical conflict with Russia. We might also recall that in February, a unit of the Patriot missile defense system was deployed to Estonia for a joint exercise with the Estonian Air Force. But in addition to develop developing anti-Russian military competencies, as you put it. We also understand that Estonia's involvement plays an ideological role in addition to a purely strategic one.
Okay, that makes more sense. Thanks a lot. Now, Patrick, some of the European Intervention Forces members are already militarily active in the West African countries of Mali and Niger, from where many migrants either originate or transit. So what's the likelihood that this block within a block will be drawn deeper into mission creep here through its partial anti-migrant purpose?
Well, in addition to their anti-migrant remit, I think that we can run through the usual checklist here. Mali has the third highest gold production in Africa after South Africa and Ghana. It also has impressive deposits of phosphates and limestone. Niger is a significant producer of oil, gold, coal, and limestone. In addition, both Mali and Niger are among 14 African countries who still pay a colonial tax to the French finance ministry and who are compelled to deposit their national reserves with the French National Bank. France has never decolonized in any meaningful sense. We note that British involvement with the mission in Mali started in 2013 after their withdrawal from Iraq and 1 year prior to their withdrawal from Afghanistan. So in addition to the anti-migrant aspect of French and British involvement in both Mali and Niger, both countries have other interests which are served separately by these deployments. In the case of the French, it's primarily a matter of tending to their colonial interests. For the British, it's primarily about maintenance of the centuries-old policy of perpetual war with a view to maintaining their overall level of military preparedness. When the British first deployed to Mali in 2013, they were quite unabashed about labeling it as a training mission.
Okay, Patrick, this is a very interesting angle from which to interpret the UK's strategic approach to the European Intervention Force. I hope that our conversation was enlightening for our listeners and helped them better understand why London would join an EU bloc within a bloc, despite Brexit.
Trendstorm.
So folks, if we think back on what both Lars and Patrick shared with us today, we can see that the motives of this new bloc, they do seem to be a bit cynical. Lars argued that there are corporate interests in mind, whereas Patrick took a more geopolitical approach as opposed to an economic one by emphasizing the effect that it can have on Western Europe. He also drew attention to the fact that despite Estonia's membership in this bloc, it isn't necessarily going to be anti-Russian. So folks, if you want to sound off and share what you think about this, please send us an email at radio@sputniknews.com or find us on Facebook. Stay with us.